basis in the Namahaskatamas. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutama Padakamam Shri Guru Vaishya Vamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ramanatam Vitam Samasajitam Sagraitam Sagraitam Krishna Saita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vashatam Vitamscha. You're still here?
Yes,
mine is
cancer.
Seriously?
Yeah,
well, your flight got cancelled? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's August 9th, 2009 in Christchurch. And we're going to be reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, the Island of Jambadweep, Chapter 19, the last verse in the chapter. And we're going to be reading Chapter 20, the Structure of the Universe, Texts 1 through 4. Do you guys read the summary at the beginning of the chapter? Yes. Okay. So we're going to be doing a lot of reading. Okay, it's a long summary. Long purport, so I'm going to be stopping and quizzing you. Otherwise, it's like, okay, it's Prabhupada's purports. So this is 5.19.31. Evam tava barotamam jambudvipa varsha devago yato padesha upavarnita iti. My dear King Parikshit, O best of the descendants of Bharata Maharaj, I have thus described to you, as I myself have been instructed, this island of Bharatvarsha and its adjoining islands. These are the islands that constitute Jambudvipa. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the fifth canto, 19th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled A Description of the Island of Jambudvipa. So what do you notice about what Sukadeva Goswami said?
He's
talking about something that he's been told. So I know when I first joined ISKCON, that was one of the main things that we were instructed in. Don't concoct anything. Repeat things in parampara. Repeat as you've been told. Don't make something up. And the same would go, of course, in the early days of ISKCON, we would only repeat things that were in Prabhupada's books. We wouldn't even, you know, look at the other books of the Goswamis, or if Prabhupada hadn't translated it, we didn't have anything to do with it. And now sometimes I think that we've gone to the other extreme, that someone just hears some folk story in Vrindavan and they go around repeating it as if it's on the same level as Srimad Bhagavatam. So we should take some care, whatever anybody else may do. We should take some care. And just like Sukadeva Goswami, we should repeat as we have heard from the authorities. That is the principle of parampara. Parampara means following one after another. And even if you're a very highly realized soul, like Sukadeva Goswami, still he's doing this. Even Krishna does this. Even Krishna is referring in the Bhagavad Gita to the Vedanta Sutra. He's referring to authority, which in one sense is a little absurd, because Vedascharaham Sarva Eva Vedyo. Krishna is the source of all of the Vedas. What need does he have to refer to Vedic authority? He is the Vedic authority. He breathes out the Vedic authority. But still, he's setting that example. So recently, one devotee was saying to me, oh, I heard that if this happens, this. And I said, you have to ask people, what is the source? If someone says, you know, if you yawn, you should just snap your fingers. You say, where is this? Please. And you can say very politely, say, excuse me, my dear Prabhu, what is your source? That's really I've never heard that before. That's really exciting. Can you tell me where I can find it? And if you're not willing to do that, then my humble suggestion is you just put it aside until you can actually verify. We had a situation recently where one very elevated, respectable leader of our movement put a quote up on his webpage, a very extraordinary quote, a quote that said something that no one had ever heard before. And I said, "This is wonderful, Maharaj. Where did this come from? Where did you get this quote from?" So he told me, "Oh, I got it from such and such GBC man." So I went to the GBC man and I said, "This is wonderful." Oh, actually, first I went to Nagaraja, Back to Godhead. And I said, "Let's put this in Back to Godhead in our Vedic Thoughts page." And he's better than me. And he went and looked up the source that was quoted. And he said, "Guess what, Armila? It's not there." So that's when I went back to Maharaj and I said, "Hey, Maharaj, where'd you get this quote from?" And he said, "I got it from so-and-so GBC man." I went to so-and-so GBC man. "Where'd you get the quote from?" "I got it from so-and-so Prabhu." I went to so-and-so Prabhu. "Where did you get the quote from?" "I got it from so-and-so Prabhu." "Oh, my dear so-and-so Prabhu, here's the Shastra that you say you're quoting from and the verse, and it's not there." Now, he did eventually find it. It took him about 4 or 5 months. And the GBC man who had first posted it kept writing these emails, "Find me the quote, find me the quote, find me the quote, find me the quote." So that's, especially if it's something that's a little funny. Yeah, I remember when Prabhupada was translating the Bhagavatams. So at this time in New York, I had a little baby, so I would listen to class downstairs on a speaker. And Rupanuga Prabhu was our GBC, then he was giving class. And I heard him say something that I'd never heard before. He said that sometimes that all of your karma can be gotten rid of in dreams. You can dream away your karma. And it also said that sometimes you can see all of your karmic reactions at one time and Krishna gets rid of them all at once. And I thought, where did that come from? So at the end of the class, I took my baby and I walked up the stairs. I said, he was then Maharaj at the time, "Maharaj, Maharaj, where's that quote from?" He says, "Oh, it's right here in this purport." Because I hadn't been in the temple room. I hadn't been able to see he was reading from the Bhagavatam. But I asked. And so this is the way at least Prabhupada trained us. Now, always make sure that, and this is actually what Krishna's training. He says in the austerities of speech, who knows the austerities of speech? The Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna's talking about austerities and goodness. He talks about austerity of the body, austerities of the mind, and austerities of speech. What does he say of the austerities of speech? Anybody know? To speak the truth. This is an important verse since most of us talk. If you don't talk, you don't need to know this verse. If you speak, it's kind of handy. Okay, so speak the truth, and what else? Pleasing. And? Should be truthful, should be pleasing. Although pleasing is at the bottom of the list. Prabhupada says you can sometimes sacrifice pleasing. What else?
Guided by Shastra.
Yes, guided by Shastra. Should be based on Vedic authority. One should regularly quote Vedic authority. And there's two more.
Repeated from Guru?
No. Well, based on Vedic authority would cover that. Vedic authority is Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. The other two are beneficial and not agitating to others. So not agitating, what's agitating to others means that it shouldn't be harsh speech, like not using curse words and things like that. Speaking in a way that's pleasant. Pleasing is referring to the content. In other words, you don't go up to someone and say, "You got a really ugly baby." Even if they do. I mean, I once met a lady who had a really ugly baby. Looked like a little pig. Really, seriously. You know, and that's truthful. It's certainly truthful. And I can say it in, you know, I wouldn't have to use nasty language. "My dear, you have such an ugly baby." But it's not pleasing. And also it's not beneficial. So of all those truthful, well, let's see if we can name them. I'm going to ask somebody else. Somebody name them for me now. Truthful.
Beneficial.
Guided by Shastra. Pleasing and? Not agitating to others. Okay. Too bad I'm not here tomorrow. I quiz you all on this. I mean, we do talk, right? Anybody here not talk? Okay. Oh, useful thing to know. So of all of them, what is the most important? Truthful. Okay. Why would you say truthful?
Because
Should we always be truthful? You say yes? No? Are there times when one should not be truthful? So what's the most important? Guided by Shastra is up there, and the other one that's the most important? Because some things there's no guidance for in Shastra. It's not that every single thing that we speak is based on Shastra, because you know there's no Shastra guidance for how to teach spelling. Not agitating is certainly important, but do we sometimes find that even Krishna speaks in a way that's agitating? Does Krishna sometimes use harsh language? That's his dhirodhata aspect, when Krishna uses harsh language with the demons. My dear Pundraka, I'm not going to take shelter of you. You know who's going to take shelter of you? The vultures and the dogs on the battlefield, or who's going to take shelter of you? That's harsh language. That's really harsh language. So sometimes Krishna speaks in harsh language. And sometimes we find the devotees also speak in harsh language. Prabhupada would say, kick on the face with boots of the, you know? Those statements are sort of embarrassing to some of us. You know, there are some of Prabhupada's disciples, followers, who don't like it that Prabhupada sometimes talked like that. Right? If they say, well, yeah, don't repeat that to people. Sometimes Prabhupada would use harsh language. Not generally. We're getting down here. There's not very many left. Beneficial. So that's the guiding principle. What benefits? And if the truth doesn't benefit people, what do, generally speaking? You don't repeat, you just don't say it. Therefore, Prabhupada says in Krishna book, in describing Vrindavan, that the saintly persons sometimes speak and are sometimes quiet. Like waterfalls that just flow at certain times of the year. And some waterfalls flow all year. But many, many waterfalls only flow after a rain. Or like even Niagara Falls sometimes freezes. I don't know if any of you have been to Niagara Falls. It's a huge waterfall. And sometimes it freezes and it doesn't flow. So if the truth is not beneficial, you don't say it. And that applies to trivial things like there's trees outside. Or something that would actually be harmful. How do we decide, by the way, whether or not truth is beneficial? Because you could say, well, truth is always beneficial, isn't it? Isn't it always good to know the truth? And Jesus said, if you know the truth will set you free. Krishna is called the supreme absolute truth, Param Satyam. So it would seem that truth is the highest principle, and most people initially say truth is the highest principle, because it seems that truth is always beneficial. But in what circumstances would truth not be beneficial?
When it's not empathic.
When it's not empathic. Okay, when you're... What I hear from... What I think you're saying is when our desire is to harm the person with the truth?
We know that the truth would hurt them.
Or we know that the truth would hurt them. Why would truth hurt somebody, though? How could truth, which is an element of the all good, all perfect, be harmful to somebody? When they're not ready for it. So of course in a practical, materialistic way, truth can be harmful. The example that Krishna gives in the Mahabharata is if murderers ask you, intending murderers, I suppose you could call them, someone who intends to commit murder, ask you where their victim has gone. You know, if you're in the middle of the war in the Congo, if any of us were brave enough or foolish enough to be preaching in the Congo right now, where they're, you know, wholesale raping not only women but men. I think they're estimating 100,000 men have been raped by the insurgent soldiers. So, you know, the soldiers come into your village and they say, you know, where can I find some rape victims? You know, tell them. You don't say, you know, maybe you've hidden your relatives under the floor of your house. You don't say, oh, by the way, they're hiding under the floor of my house. To be truthful. Actually, once had a true story like that in the Nazi occupation of Holland, where there were two sisters in a house And they were hiding two groups of people under their floor. They were hiding some Jews under their floor, and they were also hiding some young men from being drafted into the Nazi army. And some Nazi soldiers came in the house and said, "We know you're hiding people. Where are you hiding them?" And one of the sisters said, "Well, we're hiding them under the floor." And they didn't actually look there. But afterwards, the sisters were arguing about it. One said, "You shall always tell the truth." So Krishna gives that as an example of when not to tell the truth on a practical level, but on another level, when people aren't ready for it. What offense is that in chanting? Instruct the faithless about the glories of the holy name. So it's actually an offense to the truth. The holy name is also Krishna, is also the truth. It's an offense to the truth to give truth to someone who's not ready for it. Why? What does a person do if you give them truth they're not ready for? They misuse it, or they become bewildered, inimical, that it actually turns them against the truth. It puts them deeper into falsity. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his Bhaktiloka, when he's talking about Niyamagraha, which can mean either following rules and regulations superficially or just not following rules and regulations, he talks about how there's different levels of rules and regulations according to one's level of realization, which we understand that's true even in ordinary things. Just like if I was talking to Sita here, I might say, you don't subtract a bigger number from a smaller number. If she wrote down in mathematics, 3 minus 5. So I would say, no, you can't do that. Right? Can you do that? Can you do 3 minus 5? Can you have 3 things and take away 5? No. So how old are you? 7? Okay. So when you're 7, the truth is that you cannot do 3 minus 5. But I'd like to ask you adults, can you do 3 minus 5?
Yes.
Of course. What's that called?
-10.
It's called debt. People do 3 minus 5 all the time. So obviously you can do it. But if you tell that to a 7-year-old, it's just confusing. They have to grasp the basic principle. Or I would tell children up until about 8 or 9, don't start a sentence with the word because. If they do, it would always be a sentence fragment. They'd say things like, because I was hungry, in their writing. But can you start a sentence with the word because? Of course. Because I was hungry, I sat down to dinner. It is a perfectly fine sentence. So the rules are different according to one's level of realization. And the truth one gives. Right, one devotee was telling me how her children, when they were small, asked her, how are babies made? You don't usually, maybe in Sweden they do. I saw some book from Sweden for 5-year-olds. Sorry, Krishna. But generally, sorry if any of you are Swedish, or if any of you listening to this recording are Swedish, I apologize. But generally, civilized people don't give all of the details when the children are 5 or 6. They're giving truth according to the ability of the person to receive it. And to do differently is violence. Now, part of the person's ability to receive is based on their own level of understanding, and it's also based on something else. What else is it based on? How do we determine whether or not truth is beneficial? Part of it is the person's level of realization, their level of maturity, material maturity, spiritual maturity, or both. And part of it is based on something else also. The awareness of the speaker? You were going to say the qualification of the person speaking. Now, the awareness and qualification has to do a lot with relationship. Like for myself, I'm willing to say really heavy, difficult, painful truths when I'm sitting here on the Vyasasana that I'm not willing to say when I'm off of it to the same people. Because I know when I'm sitting here that everybody here can think I'm not talking about them. So many people come up to you afterwards and say, yeah, so-and-so really needed to hear that class. haha. Or, you know, I'm so glad so-and-so was in the temple room and heard what you said. It's very easy for everybody to think, she's not talking about me. Also, when I'm sitting here, and you're willingly, I hope you're all willingly sitting here. Nobody's coerced anybody into being here, right? Nobody said they're going to kill your mother or something if you don't show up. So you're willingly here, and you're, at least for this little period of time, you're accepting me as an authority, to some extent. If I say something you don't like, you can leave. And if you don't feel like you can leave and be socially acceptable, you can turn your mind off. If you feel, oh my God, what bogus nonsense this lady is saying, let me get out of here. Oh boy, but if I leave, then everybody will think I'm rude and offensive, so I guess I just have to stick it out. You know, and you take your mind to Tahiti or something. Okay? So therefore, I can do that. But afterwards, I can't walk up to one of you in the hallway and say the same kind of thing. Why? Because we don't have that relationship. It's not that you're accepting me as an authority in general. You're accepting me partially as an authority for a brief period of time. So one has to understand what relationship one has with somebody. If somebody you see, they really need to hear something, but they're not receptive to you. They might be willing to hear that truth from somebody else. In other words, that person might be spiritually mature enough to hear the truth, or materially mature enough to hear the truth, but maybe not from you. So this also has to be taken into consideration. Not that, and there's not anybody who can speak to anybody. I mean, we see even Krishna has different incarnations, which speak the truth in different ways. And different people are attracted even to different incarnations. And different representatives of Krishna present the truth in different ways at different times to different people. Why? Because there is such a thing as a personal relationship. And there has to be that personal relationship. And why do we believe somebody, by the way? Now I'm going to talk about as the recipient of truth. Why do we accept somebody? What is it that allows me to receive truth, even truth that is difficult, even truth that is not so pleasing, but yet is very beneficial for me?
Okay.
Yes. Faith. I have to trust. And what am I trusting exactly? Yes, the motives of that person, which goes back to what you said about empathy. I have to trust the motives of that person. Because even if they're speaking the truth, and even if it will benefit me, and even if I'm actually on the level to hear it, if I think that person's trying to hurt me, I'll usually cut myself off from hearing. One has to be very, very, very advanced to be willing to hear truth from an enemy. It's extremely difficult because immediately we just think, oh, this person's my enemy. Why should I listen to them? Or, you know, do you know me? So we have to trust that they care. And what else do we have to trust? Two things. We have to trust that they really care about us, that they're trying to benefit us, that they're not doing something just for their own personal motives or for some personal gain. And what else do I have to trust? And this goes back to this verse. The authority of what they're saying. I've got to trust that it's true. If I love you and care about you, but I don't know what I'm talking about, if I'm not qualified to speak, if I don't have the truth, then so what that I care about you? And if I have the truth, but I don't care about you, then I may be using truth to manipulate you in some way. So we are all supposed to be those who speak truth, right? Everybody here? We're supposed to be preachers of the truth. Is that correct? So these are very important things for us to understand. That if I want to speak truth to others, I have to, first of all, know the truth, and then I have to care. I have to be coming from a point of view of compassion. It's very distasteful to deal with a so-called preacher of the truth who is arrogant, and what we call self-righteous, who thinks, I'm telling you the truth because I know better than you, and I'm going to set you straight. What's the motive there?
Pride.
Pride. So when we're speaking about that truth, that speaking should be beneficial, that means it must come from a point of view of humility and empathy. Okay? Actually, it's funny because I hadn't really planned to talk much about this verse. All right, so what are the austerities of speech? Good teachers always summarize. You guys all know I'm a teacher, right? Or you figured it out through inductive logic, if you hadn't already known that. Okay. What are the austerities of speech?
Truthful.
Somebody else?
Beneficial.
Not agitating.
Pleasing.
And? Based on the?
Based on
Shastra. Okay. And of all them, what is the key? Beneficial. And how do you determine whether or not something is beneficial? What are the ways that one judges? Whether it's going to hurt or help the person. How do you know that? Appropriate to their level of understanding. Appropriate to their ability to receive it. And that's dependent to a large extent on your
relationship.
And what are the two main things that you have to have a relationship of trust? You have to have empathy, you have to care. You have to care, and you have to be coming from the platform of humility. Empathy means I'm really connecting with somebody. I have to really be connecting with somebody. And I have to know what I'm talking about. I have to actually have to have some authority behind me. This empathy and connecting with someone, by the way, very much relates to Vijayavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gami Hastami Suni Chagaswabhakecha Pandita Samadarshinaha, as seeing that we're all souls. I'm not better than you, not worse than you either. We're all souls. We're all essentially looking for the same thing. We're all looking for Krishna, as George Harrison said in the beginning of his Introduction to Krishna book. We're all looking for Krishna. We're all dealing with the same things to some extent or another, lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. And one speaks truth really in the way of just connecting with another soul. As Prabhupada talks about in Kunti's prayers, where she has to be detached from family members, he says one should connect soul to soul via the supersoul. So there are relationships between souls. It's not that we only relate with Krishna. We also relate with other souls. In the spiritual world, souls are relating with other souls. You know, Lalita and Vishakha are good friends. It's not just that they love Radha or just that they love Krishna. They love each other too. Nandamarj and Yasoda love each other too. Rohini and Yasoda love each other also. So this is when Krishna is at the center, then I can connect with all other souls. And that is the most satisfying thing. That is actually what we're all looking for, is this connection of soul to soul via the super soul. So this is a relationship that Sukadeva Goswami has with Maharaj Pariksit. Alright. Intend to do that. I'll read the chapter summary for chapter 20. In this chapter, there is a description. I'd like us to think when we're reading this, where's Maharaj Pariksit now in his life? I'd like us to kind of enter the scene. Yes?
A few days.
Now, we're at the fifth canto, so how many days do you think he has left?
Three or four,
maybe five. Because after the Bhagavatam, he speaks Brihad Bhagavatamrita to his mother. So that probably took him about a day. And we're a little less than halfway through. So maybe utmost 5 days to live. So you have 5 days to live. He wasn't, what was he not doing? Anybody remember what he was not doing?
Eating, drinking, or sleeping.
Who here has ever done a Nirjal Ekadasi for 24 hours? Who here has ever done a Nirjal Ekadasi with no sleeping for 24 hours? Could you do it for 7 days?
No.
I don't think so. Even by about 2 in the morning on the one day, you're kind of like, let's have a rousing kirtan, you know, and you fall asleep standing up if you're not careful. So 7 days, he hadn't been eating, sleeping, or drinking any water. And he's got maybe 5 days more to live. So if we had 5 days more to live, just to sing. So this is what he's hearing now. Okay? 5 days more to live. in this chapter, there is. I'm going to ask you, why do you think that this topic is being discussed with someone who's going to leave his body in 5 days? In this chapter, there's a description of various islands, beginning with Plakshadweep and the oceans that surround them. Would you listen to this if you had 5 days left to live? There is also a description of the location and dimensions of the mountain known as Lokaloka. The island of Plakshadweep, which is twice as broad, I'm not going to quiz you on all these details, don't worry, but I'll ask you general questions, which is twice as broad as Jambudweep, is surrounded by an ocean of salt water. The master of this island is, now this is a hard thing to say, Idmadvija, one of the sons of Maharaj Priyavrata. The island is divided into 7 regions, each with a mountain and a large river. The second island is called Samaldvipa. It is surrounded by an ocean of liquor and is 3,200,000,000 miles wide, twice as wide as Plakshadweepa. The master of this island is Yajnabahu, one of the sons of Maharaj Priyavrata. Like Plakshadweepa, this island is also divided into 7 regions, each with a mountain and a very large river. The inhabitants of this island worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the form of Chandratma. The third island, which is surrounded by an ocean of clarified butter, it'd be interesting to swim in an ocean of clarified butter, and is also divided into 7 regions, is called Kushadweepa. Its master is Hiranyaketa, another son of Maharaj Priyavrata, and its inhabitants worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the form of Agni, the fire god. Now that's going to be an important point. The width of the island is 6,400,000 miles, or in other words, twice the width of Shalmalidvipa. The fourth island is Kranchadvipa, which is surrounded by an ocean of milk. That would also be interesting, swimming in an ocean of milk. The demigods like to swim in the milk ocean. You don't really hear about them swimming in the ghee or the liquor ocean much. Maybe the demons swim in the liquor ocean. 12,800,000 miles wide, and is also divided, like the others, into 7 regions, each with a large mountain and a large river. The master of this island is Gritaprastha. Another, that's quite a name, Gritaprastha. Another son of Maharaj Priyavrata. The inhabitants of this island worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the form of water. So far, how have they worshipped Krishna? Had 3. Fire, water, and the moon, Chandratma, which probably refers to the mind. I don't know. Looks like. The fifth island, Shakadvipa, which is 25,600,000 miles wide, is surrounded by an ocean of yogurt. That would really be interesting, too. You know? Can you imagine going to the beach and it's all yogurt? It's... would be cold. Maybe there's like in this, like these oceans, you know, parts of the oceans are warm and parts of them are cold. So maybe this warm yogurt and cold yogurt. Its master is Medhatiti. I wonder how it keeps from getting rancid. Another son of Maharaj Priyavrata. It is also divided into 7 regions, each with a large mountain and a large river. So each of these places is divided into how many regions? 7. And they each have a mountain and a river. Remember, you're going to die in 5 days, right? Okay. Its inhabitants worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the form of Vayu, or air. The sixth island, Pushkaradvipa, which is twice as wide as the previous island, is surrounded by an ocean of clear water. Its master is Vihitotra, another son of Maharaj Priyavrata. The island is divided in two by a large mountain named Manasotra. Now that one's only divided into 2 instead of 7. The inhabitants of this island worship Swayambhu, another feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So who are they worshipping? Swayambhu, who's another name for it? Beyond Pushkaradweep, there are 2 islands. One is always lit by the sunshine and another always dark. Between them is a mountain called Lokaloka. So this Lokaloka mountain is very important. It divides the area of sunshine from the area of dark in the universe. And the Lokaloka is described in the Harivamsa, which is an addendum to the Mahabharata. It's also described in the 10th canto of Bhagavatam when Krishna and Arjuna are traveling through the universe, and after they pass the Lokaloka mountain, they come into a region of darkness. Okay, between them is a mountain called Lokaloka, which is situated 1 billion miles from the edge of the universe. Lord Narayana, expanding his opulence, resides upon this mountain. The area beyond Lokaloka Mountain is called Alokavarsha, and beyond Alokavarsha is the pure destinations of persons who desire liberation. So this Lokaloka, beyond there, there's an area of darkness. Then beyond there, there's what? What's beyond there? Anybody remember what Krishna and Arjuna enter into when they're traveling to find the Brahmin's stolen babies? Go to the coverings of the universe. So there's thick coverings of earth and a thicker covering, 10 times thicker water, 10 times thicker fire, 10 times thicker of air. Then the different descriptions. So sometimes it's described that there's a mahatattva, or a layer also of ego. Imagine going through a layer of ego. Sometimes it seems that there are people we meet who have these layers around their own bodies, you know, a big layer of ego. And then the layer of prakriti itself. So this is described in different ways in different places. One of the descriptions that I find the sweetest is in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Gopa Kumar enters into the Brahman. Like it says here, that beyond Alokavarsha is the pure destinations of persons who desire liberation. So Sanatana Goswami describes that those who are going to merge into the Brahman, they go through these different layers of the universe. And the description there is worth reading. In fact, it's worth reading again and again and again. It's so wonderful. How Gopa Kumar comes to the predominating deity, sees the predominating deity of each of these places. Just like we're reading here, that in each area, the people worship the Lord in a different form. Right? What forms of which they worshipped him so far that we've read? Fire, water, air, Brahma, and Chandratma, which I'm not sure exactly what that means. So this is described also in the coverings of the universe, or in the covering of earth. The predominating deity is Bhumi Devi. And who does she worship? Who's the lord of Bhumi? Who's her husband? Yes, in what form? Bhumi Devi has a son by the Lord. Yes, there you go. So she worships Lord Varaha. And then in the area of water, I forget the predominating deity there, but the form worship there is, anybody know? What form of the Lord is worshipped in water? Matsya. In the fire area, they're worshipping Surya Devi. Surya Devi, right? And in air, are they worshipping in air? I think we start coming to like Prajumna, Vasudev, Prajumna, Aniruddha. And then when you get to the last layer, the layer of Prakriti, it says that there, Prakriti herself, Mahamaya, is the predominating deity. And the form of the Lord she worships is Mohini Devi. That she's the deity there. And in each of these layers, you have finer and finer and finer and finer forms of material sense gratification. So in the original layer of Prakriti, you have the original seeds of all sense gratification. And there are jivas who live in these layers and who enjoy those subtle forms of material enjoyment. So that's what's beyond Lokaloka Mountain. Vertically, the sun globe is situated just in the middle of the universe, in Antariksha, the space between Bhurloka and Bhuvarloka. The distance between the sun and the circumference of Andagolaka, the globe of the universe, is estimated to be 25 koti yojanas, or 2 billion miles. Because the sun enters the universe and divides the sky, it is known as Martana, and because it is produced from Hiranyagarbha, the body of the Mahatattva, it is also called Hiranyagarbha. Now that's a very interesting sentence, that because the sun is produced from Hiranyagarbha, the body of the Mahatattva, it is also called Hiranyagarbha. What does Prabhupada mean by Hiranyagarbha is the body of the Mahatattva? And sometimes it's explained that this whole universe is the body of Lord Brahma. That's explained in the pastime of Lord Brahma stealing the boys and calves. It said, like, our body is 7 cubits for us, so Lord Brahma's body is the universe. And sometimes, of course, the Lord's body is also compared to the universe. So, of course, Brahma also has his own form, but in another sense, he has the form of the universe. And so does Krishna. When we talk about the super soul, often in Sanskrit said, the soul of souls. So it's as if the whole universe is his body and he is the soul. Something like in this body, we have so many, Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj talked to Prabhupada about this, We have, there's so many cells that are alive. There's so many little jivas. Right? My hands are made up of all these little cells that are alive. But I'm the super soul of the body, of all these little cells. I'm the super self of those cells. Like in a business, you've got a director and then you've got all these people working there. And then of the whole universe, Krishna is the super soul of all of us. Kunti also prays like this. O soul of souls. He is the soul of our soul. And we are all like a little cell in this universal body. This, of course, is described very nicely in the same pastime of the stealing of the boys and calves when Maharaj Parikshit asked, how is it that the residents of Vrindavan love Krishna more than their own children? And Sukadeva Goswami says that really the person we love the most is ourselves. That even more than our family, even more than our society, we love ourselves. And the self of the self is Krishna. So that's our, Krishna is our ultimate lovable object. Okay, going into text one, which you have up there. Yes, but it's not a, it's a prose verse. Ata param plakshadinam sisuguvacha ata pranam param plakshadinam pramana lakshana samstanato varsha bigava vibhava upavarnyate. Should we do the word for word for this one? I don't think so. The great Saint Sukadeva Goswami said, hereafter I shall describe the dimensions, characteristics, and forms of the six islands, beginning with the island of Pluxor. Now we're going to go on to text two. I'm not going to read the sentence. As Sumeru Mountain is surrounded by Jambudvipa, Jambudvipa is also surrounded by an ocean of salt water. The breadth of Jambudvipa is 100,000 yojanas, or 800,000 miles. And the breadth of the saltwater ocean is the same. As a moat around a fort is sometimes surrounded by a garden-like forest, the saltwater ocean surrounding Jambudvipa is itself surrounded by Plakshadvipa. The breadth of Plakshadvipa is twice that of the saltwater ocean. In other words, how many thousand yojanas? Or were you all spaced out? 200,000, good. 1,600,000 miles. Remember, you're going to die in 5 days, okay? This must be important stuff. Sukadeva Goswami is not going to waste your time telling you something that's not important if you're going to die in 5 days. All right. On Plakshadvipa there is a tree shining like gold and as tall as a jambu tree on Jambudvipa, as its root is a fire with 7 flames. Wouldn't that be nice to see all these things? It is because this tree is a Plakshadvipa tree that the island is called Plakshadvipa. Plakshadvipa was governed by, oh, this is his name again, Idma Jiwa, like tongue maybe. Idma Jiwa. I wouldn't like to have a name, Idma Jiwa. One of the sons of Maharaj, imagine if you had that name in New Zealand. One of the sons of Maharaj Priyavrata. He endowed the 7 islands with the names of his 7 sons, which we've already read, divided the islands among the sons, and then retired from active life to engage in the devotional service of the Lord. So we have a little hint here of the Varnashram system, that at a certain point one must retire. Like Prabhupada said in the shop has its hours, we close at 5, and doesn't matter if there's more customers or more things to do, they just close at 5. You ever had that experience? That you're outside the store at 5:02? Especially government places tend to do that, don't they? The post office, banks, yeah. I had that happen once at a bank. I swear I was there 2 minutes before closing. But they would not let me in. So in the same way, at a certain point, you retire. It doesn't matter. I have so many more things to do. Oh, but I got this to do, and that to do, and this to do, and that to do, and this to do. Certain point, you retire from the world. You give up sex life, give up economic development. I don't think most of us are going to live in the forest with old torn clothing and matted hair. I've thought about it, but I didn't think dreadlocks would be quite so appropriate for preaching. But it says that in the Bhagavatam, you know, you're supposed to wear old torn clothing and matted hair. And you're supposed to not even have a home. You're just supposed to have a cave to keep the sacred fire and you live outside. You know, I can hardly survive without a heater. But at least one should be giving up engagement in worldly activities at a certain point. ready or not, you know. Because death is going to come, ready or not, here we come. Death doesn't wait. You can't say, oh, but I want to finish this, and I want to finish that, and this, and that, and the other thing. Sorry. Time's up. Okay? I have a little comic I show in one of my presentations of the Grim Reaper standing by a door, knocking on a door, and the lady says to her husband, he says we're out of any time minutes. No, it's done. So the idea is that you die before you die. And Prabhupada talks about sannyas, the civil death. If you're already dead, then death doesn't matter anymore now, does it? When my mother died, she had moved into a nursing home a year before and already given away pretty much all her possessions. She kept one chair, one like lounge chair, and one painting, which she then gave to my father. And she had one drawer of clothes, which she told us before she died. She said, you can give that to charity. Even most of her, the inheritance she'd given to us when she was alive. She said, better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. It was great. There was nothing for us kids to take care of after she died. You know, it was a matter literally of 20 minutes to deal with her stuff. When you've already died before death, what is this thing of death? If you've already given up your attachment to your possessions, to your home, to your family, to your body, to everything, what does it matter if it's taken away? Right? We were talking yesterday how pain comes from
attachment.
100% of our suffering is caused by our attachment. It's not Krishna's fault. It's not even the circumstances we're in. It's that we're attached. The same circumstance happening to someone that we don't care about wouldn't bother us at all. It's attachment. So therefore, give up your attachment before it's pulled away from you. It will be pulled away, it will be taken away. This was Bali Maharaj's thinking when Vamandev came. Vamandev comes, says, I want 3 paces of land. And Sukracharya says, he's Vishnu. He's going to take everything. His 3 steps are not like ordinary steps. Don't do this. Because of course, Sukracharya was thinking, this guy's maintaining me. If he loses everything, then I'll lose my job. I'll lose my salary. Don't give him anything. Don't give him anything. And Bali Maharaj says, you know, I'm going to lose everything at death anyway. He says, why not voluntarily give to Vamandev everything I'm going to lose at death? Nadanam, nadanam, nasundarim, kavitamba, jagadisha kamaye. Danam. Anybody keep their wealth after death? No. Nadanam. Followers? I mean, you may keep your followers after death, but what good is it to you? I know one devotee kid who right now is in the 24-hour kirtan in Vrindavan. And some astrologers told his parents when he was born, said, your son in his previous life was a great acharya in India. And still he has many disciples who are worshipping his photograph. I don't know if it's true or not, but even if it is, so what? Suppose I told you that right now there are 500 people worshipping the photograph of you in a previous life. It'd be kind of embarrassing, you know, actually, to go there and say, I'm still here. You know, people are so concerned with their reputation after death, the demons can really be convinced to do things that way. That's how Krishna convinced Jarasandha to battle. He said, it will give you a good reputation after death. How silly. What are you going to do, hang around your graveyard as a ghost? You know, read the obituaries in your ghost form? Wow. You know? I had a memorial service for me with 100,000 people attending. Whoa! What use is it? You're already in another body. And so our wealth is gone at death. Our reputation is gone at death. At least it doesn't matter anymore. Now, Sundarin, your beautiful wife, handsome husband, or your own personal beauty. What dead body is beautiful? Dead bodies are not beautiful. Now, that's gone. Everything in this world is already going to be taken away. So why not? And who's taking it away? Who is death? Krishna. Prabhupada says it's like the parent who says to the children, okay, time to put your toys away. Time to turn off the computer game. Right? That's what this is. Sariputta said this whole world is like a big computer game. Right? Shastra says it's like a dream. But if I have a dream about you, you don't have the same dream about me, right? But if we play a computer game together, it's a shared illusory experience. It's like a shared dream. So, you know, the parents say, okay, you had a high game, you have a half an hour quota of your time playing the game. It's up now. Turn it off. So Krishna says, okay, that act is over. That little drama where you were pretending to be Urmila. Okay, done now. So why not give Krishna your toys before he asks you to put them away? And you know what it's like when you tell the kids it's time to put them away. Even if you warn them. Even if you said, 5 more minutes, I'm going to take your, you know, time to put the toys away. Right? Krishna warns us. Hair starts turning gray. Cheeks start sagging. One devotee recently looked at the old Back to Godhead picture of me when I was like 25. She said, who's that? I said, that's me. No. You know, so everything starts sagging, everything starts hurting. And, you know, you see all the 20-year-old girls dancing in the kirtan and you try to do it for about 5 minutes and then you're like, man, I can't do that. So that's the warning. That's Krishna saying, 5 more minutes, you're going to have to put the toys away. And often what do the kids do then? You say, okay, 1 more minute, toys get put away. They say, no, we put them longer. Right? Then it's painful. And it's painful. So the idea is that everybody should take sannyas, not necessarily externally, but everybody should become detached. At a certain point, we say, done. And then who cares? Krishna takes the toys away or Krishna doesn't take the toys away. They're his toys, not my toys. Those are never my body, my clothes, my family, my home, my books, my reputation, my wealth, my this, my that. Let me say, Krishna, take back what's yours whenever you want it, at least at a certain point, right? Which is supposed to be 50. Of course, nowadays people don't even get married till they're 50, so it's a little difficult. Anyway. Okay, I'll say anything more about this. Now we're going to go on to text 3. We have a very backwards culture, isn't it? Used to be like you get married when you're a teenager. Did you know that? Even the boys got married as teenagers? And you had your babies when you were a teenager, or you were in your 20s, and then by the time you were 50, you could renounce the world?
Yeah. Like killing themselves when you're
it may have something to do with it. Prabhupada's really emphatic. He said that the parents should get their children married before they go, he says, before they go madly. Anyway. So nowadays we say, wait. It doesn't work very well. It's not biologically sound, it's not psychologically sound. Anyway, this is a paid political announcement. But, you know, what to say. There's a lot of suffering. I mean, even biologically, women's peak fertility is, I think, 18 to 20, and men's are 20 to 22. You know, even biologically, it doesn't work very well. First, go to school. First, get your master's, get your PhD, have a career, get established in your career. Then when you're 45, think about having kids. You know, it's backwards. And there's harm done in society. First of all, it greatly encourages illicit sex. It's not that everybody waiting until they're 25 or 35 or 45 are all celibate. You know, that's just not the reality. Which means then it's encouraging birth control and abortion and so many things. And then people are not having children when they're biologically and psychologically most suited to having children. And then the children are very young when it's time to renounce. And then, of course, add to that the divorce and remarriage and divorce and remarriage and divorce and remarriage, our modern serial polygamy. You know? And you add that whole thing to the mix, and then it's a mess. Anyway, at least we can just chant Hare Krishna. Even in a mess, you can just chant Hare Krishna. Because trying to get things sorted out at the present time is really tough. Really, really tough. And not very many of us have a normal situation. That's rare, you know. When you meet somebody who has like a normal situation, it's something extraordinary. Wow, you got married when you were 20 and you had your kids in your 20s and they all grew up and they're all sane contributors to society and you guys love each other and get along with each other when you're 50 and then, you know, you can renounce the world at 50 and your kids can take over. And you know, how many people you meet like that? You know, if you meet one out of 300, like, wow, that's really impressive. It used to be just normal. used to be. It's kind of like eating healthy food. You know, everybody used to eat healthy food. The only food grown was organic food. I mean, there wasn't any, people didn't use pesticides and herbicides. It didn't exist. It was just normal to eat the food you grew from your own garden and you canned from your own garden. Everybody did that. Nobody had to worry about breathing pollution and things like that. And now it's like, wow. This couple in Slovenia, they grow all their own food, not their grains. And they eat only raw food from their garden. Wow, this is impressive. Anyway, so whatever we have, we have to eat all this crazy food, and our family situations are inside out and upside down. At least we can chant Hare Krishna. All right. The seven islands, Varshas, are named according to the names of those seven sons: Shiva, Yavasa, Subhadra, Shanta, Kshema, Amrita, and Abhaya. In those seven tracts of lands, there are seven mountains and seven rivers. It looks like the Priyavata's sons didn't give their sons such odd names. They gave them shorter names. Not going to comment on that. The mountains are Manikuta, Vajrakuta, Indrasena, Jyotishman, Suparna, Hiranyastiva, and Meghamala. And the rivers are named Aruna. Boy, how do you say this one? Nrimna. Agirasi, Savitri, Suptabhata, Rittambhata, and Satyambhata. One can immediately be free from material contamination by touching or bathing in those rivers, and the four castes of people who live in Plakshadweep, the Hamsas, Patangas, Urdhvayanas, and Satyangas, purify themselves in that way. The inhabitants of Plakshadweep live for 1,000 years. They are beautiful like the demigods, and they also beget children like the demigods, which probably means they just have one child at the end of life that grows up very fast. By completely performing the ritualistic ceremonies mentioned in the Vedas, and by worshipping the Supreme Personality of God as represented by the sun god, they attain the sun, which is a heavenly planet. According to general understanding, their original Prabhupada is going to speak about the relationship between Vishnu and the devas, because here it's saying they worship the Lord as the sun. According to general understanding, there are originally three deities, Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, and Lord Shiva, and people with a poor fund of knowledge consider Lord Vishnu no better than Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva. The conclusion, however, is invalid. As stated in the Vedas, istapurtam bahuda jayamanam vishvan bibarti bhuvanasya nabi tad Evagnis tad, Vayus tad, Suryas tad, U Chandrama, Agni Sarva Daivata. This means that the Supreme Lord, who accepts and enjoys the results of Vedic ritualistic ceremonies, technically called Istapurta, who maintains the entire creation, who supplies the necessities of all living entities, Eko Bahanam Yo Viradati Kaman, and who is the central point of all creation, is Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu expands as the demigods known as Agni, Vayu, Surya, and Chandra, who are simply parts and parcels of his body. Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 9:23, Ye payanta devata bhakta, yajyante shradavan vita, ye timam eva kanteya, yajyantya vidipurvakam. Prabhupada talks about this a lot, avidipurvakam, how you lose your intelligence if you worship the demigods. Devotees who worship the demigods with firm faith worship me also, but not according to regulated principles. That's interesting. Prabhupada translates here, not according to regulated principles. He often says they're doing it in the wrong way. It's just like rubbing food on your hand instead of putting it in your mouth.